Hello, hello, and hello, everybody. Welcome back for another episode, If Not Now, When. In today's show, I am super excited to welcome my friend Jay O'Shea to join us today. If you know Jay, Jay is a professional matchmaker and super connector. He is currently worked as a director of portfolio operation at Foundation Capital. He is building a tools and system to operate the firm's network and leading the firm's platform and portfolio supporting function. Prior to Foundation, Jay was part of a Capital Factory, where he was responsible for managing and developing the firm's value-added initiatives for portfolio companies. Jay is also co-organizer for AITX, a local Austin AI community, and also co-founder for Seren AI, a ChatGPT-powered network management tool. With that, everybody, I'm super excited. Please join me to welcome Jake to the show. Well, Jake, thank you so much for joining us today. We are super excited to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
What an honor. So let's dive in. Tell us, how does all that begin for you, Jake?
All of like just my career up to this point?
Your life, your career, however you want to begin.
Yeah. Maybe I'll start. Growing up, I grew up in a suburb outside of Houston, pretty standard American suburban growing up experience. When I was in high school, I discovered speech and debate and got super into arguing with other people. And
Did you always win?
No. I did not always win. And that was part of what I really enjoyed about it. It's really like a mental exercise of having to argue things that you don't necessarily believe, but make the case as convincingly as possible. And I just really enjoyed playing with ideas and trying to find different angles on it, and really thought that I wanted to kind of work professionally in something like government or lobbying or just something kind of in that vein, because I liked, you know, the debates we would argue about are always about some sort of like governmental policy or, you know, some kind of idea that you had to defend or disprove. And so when I graduated from high school, I went to school at UT here in Austin and studied government, and really kind of thought that was going to be what I did for my life. And like many college students, I kind of quickly discovered that, you know, what I was going to school for was maybe not what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
What is the one turning point? What do you realize?
I did an internship my freshman summer. It was the summer of 2016. So it was right when U.S. politics started going a little crazy. It was Trump versus Hillary Clinton. I had gotten a job working at a local political action committee. And what was interesting is that I actually liked the work. The work was calling representatives, calling other nonprofit organizations, lobbying groups, and kind of just aligning on who we're going to support, initiatives, policy, stuff like that. But I had this kind of realization that everyone I worked with was great, but when they talked about the opposing side of the aisle, it became pretty clear that they didn't see the validity of the other side's point of view or arguments. And like in debate, kind of like I mentioned, you've got to take both sides of the argument. So you've got to be able to see that there's more than one way to skin a cat. There's two sides to every coin. Like there's no just definite, this is right and this is wrong. And everything is going to have areas of gray and like points where you need to compromise. And I kind of just realized that in government, your job is not actually to, like in debate, there's a winner and a loser, right? I didn't always win, but there was always someone who won and someone who lost. And it felt like in politics, everyone kind of loses. And the goal is really to make the other side seem like they're wrong, as opposed to like making your side seem like they're right, if that makes sense. So
yeah.
I just kind of got the sense that
that's not for you.
Not a lot of stuff is going to get done, right? And you'll become a person that is pretty argumentative, that doesn't like to kind of find common ground with other people. And I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. So that said, with a degree in government, there's not a whole lot of job opportunities outside of government. So I started taking pretty much any internship that I could find. And most of them were unpaid, and they were like all sorts of different things. I was an executive assistant, and then the kind of like operations associate to the director of a nonprofit and really just anything that sounded interesting. And one of those jobs when I was working with the nonprofit is a company called Water to Thrive here in Austin. They dig wells in Ethiopia. And so it was a really cool mission. And they're really everything they worked on was about how do they get more donations and raise more money so that they can then go do more trips to Ethiopia and dig more wells. And Ethiopia is the birthplace of coffee. Austin is a big coffee city, as you know. So I was working on this idea around like a coffee festival for the city of Austin. So you get a lot of the local roasters, you do kind of a traditional Ethiopian coffee ceremony, and it all becomes this big fundraiser for Water to Thrive. And so through that process, I was kind of like mapping out what the event would look like. I was identifying the roasters in Austin, coordinating meetings where we could all get together and talk about the event, et cetera. And I kind of had this realization that, you know, if I were doing this on my own, I could probably sell tickets and pay my bills. And like for me going to school, I really just wanted to find a job that allowed me to stay in Austin, was interesting, and let me pay my bills. And I didn't care about like title or what I was doing. Like I just wanted to be interested in it and I wanted it to pay my bills. And so I really liked kind of the whole idea of event planning, and that really opened up my eyes to entrepreneurship. And then entrepreneurship at the time, they had just started an entrepreneurship minor at UT. And I was going into my junior year and still kind of didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but knew that I was interested in that. They really wanted non-business students to sign up for the minor because, you know, entrepreneurship kind of lends itself to business majors, some engineering majors, but definitely not liberal arts majors. So I think when I applied, they were just excited someone in liberal arts wanted to do entrepreneurship. So they accepted me, and then I was able to do some classes around business and entrepreneurship. And through that, there was a kind of an internship course where I got to work with a local startup. And it was a company then called Logix. Now it's called Oliver Technologies. I think they went through Capital Factory, but it was basically legal automation. And what I loved about it was I've kind of always had this approach where if you give me a task and it's something that I need to do, just rinse and repeat this same process 100 times. I'll spend twice as much time as it would take to just manually do it to figure out how to automate it. And just because that's the way that I like to think about problems, and that's what feels exciting to solve, is figuring out how to like automatically do this same process over and over. And during the internship, we were basically tasked with helping map out expansion opportunities and where the company should grow. And so that involved manually going to this website, seeing the density of lawyers in specific areas, comparing that manually with the number of potential like client accounts that the company would have in that area, and basically analyzing that and saying, hey, these are kind of the three markets where it makes the most sense to go into. And so my whole team, there was four of us, we were all kind of manually doing this copy paste work into an Excel spreadsheet. And I, after like 1 week of it, I was like, I can't do this anymore. So I spent the rest of my time really figuring out how to do web scraping so that I could kind of automate that entire process. And like 2 weeks after that, I kind of had it figured out and I ran the process and it worked perfectly. And we were able to like kind of finish the entire project in, you know, a third of the time that it would have taken if we were kind of doing everything manually. And what I loved about it was a startup. And I kind of got a sense for what working at a startup meant. And it's really that you're going to wear a lot of different hats. You're just going to have a directive. There's not always going to be like a defined process that you need to follow to achieve that goal. And you kind of got to figure it out. At the same time, startups, there's lots of different ideas. There's a real opportunity to make an impact. And so that for me was kind of that moment where everything clicked. And I was like, oh, okay, I can combine kind of the things that appeal to me about government with something that I actually like maybe want to do professionally. And then at the same time, you know, I was in my senior year, I was trying to figure out what do I do when I graduate college. And I knew I wanted to still work with lots of different startups because I still knew that kind of inside me, I wanted to start a company of my own someday. I just didn't have the idea that made sense to run with. So I then started looking at the way to work with as many startups as possible. And that led me down the accelerator rabbit hole. I applied to like 8 different jobs at Capital Factory. I didn't get the first 7. And then I had been working with a guy named Nick Spiller, who I believe you know pretty well.
Yeah.
I had been working with him through a club at UT and really helping him organize events that help founders connect with legal experts, marketing experts, like just finding assistance and help to solve their problems. And I really loved that work that I was doing with him. And he let me know that he had started this new function at Capital Factory called Investor Relations, and he had just gotten approval to hire on a first coordinator. And so when that role came up, I applied for that and was able to kind of work my way through the interview process and got that role. And really, that was a big inflection point for me in my career because it allowed me to work in venture capital with startups right out of school, which is just super great timing, great luck, great opportunity. And about 5 or 6 months into that role, Nick actually went part-time. He had started his own business. And so I kind of was left to my own devices to kind of run the investor relations program as I thought it needed to be run. And he would come in and kind of help guide me through these different situations like once or twice a week. But I really kind of learned the nitty-gritty and really dug into like building up that program. And through that process, I ended up needing to build like a data infrastructure for Capital Factory. They were on Salesforce, and just to like query a list of companies that fit a certain criteria, like show me all the oil and gas startups. We had this Google spreadsheet that would generate a SQL query that would ping like a Salesforce database. And it was all very convoluted. It took forever to load. It was a lot of times inaccurate. I had to kind of learn SQL so that I could fix the queries because it broke all the time. And I basically was just like, there's got to be a better way to do this. And was able to work with somebody that I met there. And we kind of rebuilt the data to be all on Google Sheets. And it was a big improvement and it was really awesome. And so we were able to kind of double down on what we were doing with investor relations, really start scaling it up. Eventually later when COVID hit, Capital Factory had to do a lot of layoffs. And so then it was kind of literally just me. Nick had moved to a different team and I had to figure out a way to keep the ship afloat and continue making investor introductions because that's really my job on the investor relations team at Capital Factory was make as many investor intros as possible.
And let's talk about that because today a lot of founders on the other end are just about to enter this process. How does the investor relationship or conversation generally start for founders? If he or she don't not lucky enough have someone like you on the other end to make those intros, how do you, you know, advising or, you know, speak about that experience?
Yeah. It was a really interesting role because on one half, you are talking to investors, understanding their investment thesis, what they look for in founders and companies. And then on the other hand, it was coaching founders on how to navigate that process and position themselves to be successful.
So let's talk about the process first and foremost.
Yeah. So we did this really great program there called the Series A Prep Academy. And so we brought in two really experienced fundraisers, a guy named John Durvin. He was I think the COO at Austin Ventures, kind of the OG venture fund here in Austin, worked there 30 years, helped a bunch of companies raise money. Then the second was Chris Traylor, serial entrepreneur, had like three companies go public. He's working on a new startup now, like very impressive guy, raised a lot of capital. And they taught this process that really had three phases. The first is preparation, and that's basically how much money are you raising? What are the outcomes that this money will drive? What is your pitch deck? What is kind of the acceptable valuation range or how much dilution are you willing to take on?
And let's quickly talk about that.
Sure, yeah. We can go step by step.
That's please. That sounds great. So first step, you talk about pitch deck, talk about evaluation, talk about how much money you're raising. So a lot of founders are thinking, it's your first time or second time. How much money actually should he or she raise? How do you think about that math?
Yeah. There's no right answer or wrong answer. Like when you think about
so much art and science.
Yeah, it's much more art than science. Yeah, to be totally honest. Especially at like the pre-seed seed stage. When you think about fundraising in general, you have this idea of being like fully financed, meaning that you can grow on your own terms. You're cash flow break even or profitable, and you don't need to raise any external funding. So let's say you're a company and you need $10 million to hit that point where you're fully funded. You mm-hmm. can grow the business sustainably just from the revenues your customers are giving you. Fundraising strategy is about how do you break that 10 million into chunks that both optimize for the inflection points of the company and the milestones in de-risking the company itself, and optimizing at the same time on the founder end for their own dilution, making sure they own as much of the company as possible. And so what I always recommend companies do is like start by just mapping out the company where it's at today, your cash balance, your cash burn rate, figure out when that's going to go negative, and then look at where your KPIs are going to be from there. And once you understand kind of when you go negative and what your KPIs are, you'll have a sense for, all right, will this be exciting to investors? And sometimes you've got to talk to investors. This kind of goes into mm-hmm. the next step, but mm-hmm. you want to understand like what are the big milestones that an investor is looking for.
And how, to know that, you speak to investors, you do your own research, you do
There's a lot of really good research online. I think competitive analysis and fundraising doesn't make sense, because as an investor, so much of it is based on like how much you think that person or that team is going to be able to go seize this opportunity. Mm-hmm. So you could have one team that has like no traction, mm-hmm. barely built a product, mm-hmm. didn't build a product, and they're going to have an easier time fundraising than a company that's been in market for 6 months, has early customer traction, et cetera.
Why?
Because investment is like, as an investor, you're de-risking three things about a company. The first is market risk. Will people pay for this? That's kind of easy to prove. Just show people paying for it. The second is technology risk. Is this technology feasible to build and implement? But the third is execution risk. And execution risk is, can this team and this founder go capture this opportunity? Mm-hmm. And the only way to de-risk that is to have proven it in the past, right? And get people to kind of buy into that background, or to show them you executing over a long period of time to where they feel confident, okay, if I invest in this company, they're going to go execute on their plan the way they say they're going mm-hmm. to. And that is very much an art, not a science. It's all about the judgment of the investor. Exactly.
And on that note, circle back to what you speak about, how much raise and what milestone you are achieving. Mm-hmm. For those APIs specifically in that conversation, do you come up with that by yourself? You talk to investors, you're looking at other benchmark?
It depends on why you're raising the money, yeah. right? There's all these terms that get thrown around: pre-seed, seed, series A, series B. It's the amounts don't matter. It's why are you raising the money? You can raise a $15 million pre-seed round if you're using that $15 million to go build a product.
Mm-hmm. So let's quickly talk about pre-seed, C, and A. How exactly. do you clarify?
Yeah, so pre-seed, you're raising money so that you can build a product.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Seed is you've got a product. Now you need to find product market fit. Mm-hmm. How do you find a scalable, repeatable sales process mm-hmm. where you know if I put $10 in here, I get $11 out here.
Nice.
Series A is to pour fuel on the repeatable sales process mm-hmm. and scale it up as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And then Series B is to get unit economics, so the mm-hmm. power of scale, and then enter adjacent markets. Mm-hmm. So basically add this additional product that grows the market size of the company. And kind of every round past a Series B is going to be some flavor of unit economics, so optimizing for scale, or entering and capturing adjacent opportunities. So
exciting.
Yeah, with kind of that framework in mind, if you're raising a pre-seed round, the question is really, how much runway do you need to build a product where you can get your first initial like 5 to 10 customers? And you can map that out by, again, going to a spreadsheet, mapping out how much you plan to burn each month, mapping out how long it's gonna take to build this MVP, get these first few customers, and then adding 3 months to that because it never goes quite as it planned.
Yes.
And then you can just look in the spreadsheet and you'll see, oh, it looks like I need this much in order to get this much runway, which will give me the time to execute on this plan. So that's kind of the way that I would think about it if I was a founder that's going out to fundraise for the first time. And for seed, it's the same thing. What is kind of a semblance of product market fit? What puts me in a good position to raise a Series A? General rule of thumb is $1 million in annual recurring revenue. Hopefully you're doubling or tripling year over year in terms of growth. And so just kind of map out based on your plan, mm-hmm. your cash balance, your cash burn rate, mm-hmm. when are you going to hit those metrics? Mm-hmm. And if you realize that you're not going to hit those metrics in time before your money runs out, then maybe you go raise some bridge funding, you raise money from angels, mm-hmm. give yourself that room so that you can go into a Series A and successfully raise that.
There's so much goodies in that, Jay. Thank you for breaking it down, because I think those terms are a little bit interchangeable-ish and it's confusing. So thank you for kind of really speak about that. You mentioned about bridge round, which is cool to a lot of founders, a little bit confusing and scary. But at this kind of, you know, environment, a lot of people are thinking about that. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how do you approach that before we go to a step two?
Yeah, so a bridge round is basically when you're coming up on the next round of funding that has like a name, right? So you're going from pre-seed to seed, seed to A to B, whatever. And you basically have done that exercise I mentioned where you look at that template and you realize, oh no, I'm going to run out of money before I hit the milestones that I need to raise this next round of funding. So a bridge basically means raising a smaller amount of capital that bridges that gap and gives you enough runway to get to the point where you have the metrics to raise the next round. And I think in general, your job as a founder or a CEO specifically is hire awesome people, talk to customers, and make sure that your company doesn't run out of money. So there's a lot of people that are scared of a bridge round because it causes them to sell more of the company or they won't get the valuation they want, et cetera. Like, keep the company alive. You know, if the company is going to die, you can waste a lot of time trying to raise a Series A before you're ready.
Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense to just go back to your existing investors, say, hey, here's how we're executing on plan. Mm-hmm. We're not tracking the way we thought we would be. We need this much capital, which will get us to these metrics, which will put us in a great position to raise a good Series A. Mm-hmm. Right. And you are then going to be able to get more exposure to the company at a lower valuation. And so you've got to kind of first start by approaching your initial investors and kind of pitching them on that. If you don't get enough capital from the existing investors, then go start talking to individual angel investors. There are some funds that will do kind of like a between seed and Series A, like Foundation Capital, where I currently work. They like deals like that. But most firms are going to want you to kind of be at some of those predefined milestones. Mm-hmm. So go back to angels, go back to find strategic operators in your industry, whatever, and get that capital so that you can go into raising your next round and actually hit the milestones. Because otherwise you're going to end up spinning your wheels and wasting your time and money.
Yeah. And thank you for telling us that, because I know this is a lot of just a scary thing. Some people, not people talking about it or even admit that they are, you know, in the process of that. So thank you for telling us, because as a founder, your only job is keep everybody alive and thriving. So sometimes you do have to do some act that maybe not as most exciting, but it's necessary.
I had a founder friend give me this analogy over the weekend that I thought was really good. But you're either pushing a boulder up a hill and the goal is like keep pushing it up the hill until it gets to the top, or you've gotten it over the hill and then you're chasing it down and hoping you don't get crushed. Like, one way or another, you're trying to avoid getting crushed, like a boulder. Yeah.
The animal?
No, a boulder, like a rock, a big rock.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, just an interesting visual in my mind. What do you mean by not get run over on the way down?
So
what is analogy? Is that means when you are accelerating up to A round and not go too fast?
It doesn't matter when it happens, but with most startups, if they're truly like a venture scale, hyper growth company, there's going to be some point where you've gathered enough momentum that it's no longer pushing the boulder up the hill, getting things to work. Now it's chasing the boulder down the hill and making sure that you can execute on everything and continue growing at that pace.
Oh, so you don't want to have a boulder go too fast and you can't catch, and now it's a...
Yeah. Well, really, I think the better analogy is push it up, right? And then if it rolls down, it crushes you, right?
Oh,
but once
it gets to the
top, you actually get in front of the boulder.
Got it.
And now you're running down the hill hoping that it doesn't hit you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And every company's goal should be to... It's better to be running down the hill, right, than pushing it up. But you're still at some point trying to make sure that the company stays alive and that you can kind of execute and just live to see another week, another day, another month.
Live to see another day. I love that.
Yeah, it's very hard. Like, it's not a glamorous life. Like, it's all the founders that I've talked to, especially the ones that have raised venture capital that are really trying to build a huge world-changing company that's going to IPO, like... They just work incredibly hard. The stakes are really high. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot of upside and opportunity there as well, but I don't think people give founders enough credit. Like, it's really, really freaking hard.
I think, you know, we oftentimes look at this, you know, news release or all those amazing articles and say, wow, XYZ just raised this much and that seems so exciting and glamorous, and you are 100% right. This path is extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. Difficult all around, whether it's physically, emotionally, financially, all the things, and there are a lot to juggle, you know, in the air.
And you feel it too. You're an entrepreneur, right?
Of course.
It's like you get everything is on your shoulders. You know, if something doesn't happen, like, it's on you, right? And so it's a lot of stress, and not everyone is like kind of interested in that.
I don't think it's for everybody, mm-hmm. but I also have a sense that I feel like when you have something just in your heart that you just felt like you couldn't not do that. Mm-hmm. There's almost like there's no choice. Yeah. It's hard, but what else are you going to do? Die? You either live or not.
Yeah.
And
for
a lot of founders, when is their mission, what is life work? It is that. And therefore, I think it's extremely incredible to have a leader, you know, incredible, smart people like you to share those experiences and advice so we can, you know, maybe take a little bit more shortcut or avoid some mistakes so we can, you know, get to the next step faster.
Yeah. Well, and just to be clear, this was not my analogy. Like, I am not a founder. I'm not living that life.
But you are someday, maybe. And but supporting, advising so many amazing founders. And
definitely. That is, I've worked with a lot of founders for sure.
I think there are two kind of innovation in the world. Number one here is I creating a complete new wheel of this whole world, which is a great first wheel of the world. Second is now I taking the past experience of someone create this amazing wheel, I summarize all the amazing know-how, and I create something new. And I think you are at the moment, right, as a leader, supporting founder, whether it's in Capital Factory or the fund that you're part of, you are supporting, advising incredible founders, incredible numbers of founders. You're seeing different kind of, you know, sector, vertical, different stage of growth, different kind of founder, different kind of product market fit levels of that success, let's call it. And therefore, your insight are tremendously, incredibly important for founders on other end, maybe just begin the process, maybe still confused by the turns, or even just scary by thinking about raising capital mm-hmm. as a whole. So truly appreciate that insight.
Yeah, no, of course.
So let's talk about evaluation a little bit in the phase one before we go to phase two. Uh-huh. For pre-seed, seed, and A, I mean, they are still a little bit early, right? How do they think about how much do I evaluate my company? And on that note, what vehicle should I go into? Save, convertible, price equity, all that fancy terms.
Let's start with that. That's good one. Your valuation as a pre-seed company, if you're really trying to build a venture scale mm-hmm. company, is meaningless, right?
It doesn't mean anything, right?
It's not based on any forward-looking revenue metrics, like mm-hmm. the investors are not valuing it like that. VC funds have different strategies, but all of them have what's called an LP agreement, mm-hmm. right? So their LPs, their limited partners, are the people that give them the money to invest in startups. These are people like the UT endowment, pension funds, you know, different state financing vehicles, et cetera. In their LP agreement, they talk about what their strategy is. And their strategy generally includes some sort of like target ownership percentage that they're going to invest. So standard investments for this fund, we target 15% ownership. We reserve this much of the fund to follow on or do pro rata, et cetera. We stop investing after this round. Like, it's not always that specific, but in general, they all have a financial model, the funds do, on the back end saying, we in general need to get this much ownership of this company. Because after they raise more rounds of funding, their ownership gets diluted down. And then if the exit is this big, that results in this much capital back to the fund. So founders should take a similar approach. It's not about how much your company is worth. It's an equation. And it's how much money do you need to get to that next inflection point to raise the next round? And how much of your company are you willing to sell? So if you need $2 million to get to that next inflection point as a company, and you're willing to sell up to 20% of your company, then you're basically or you're willing to sell max 20% of the company, then your minimum valuation is going to be $10 million, right? If you're willing to sell up to 30% of your company or 33%, well, now your minimum acceptable valuation is $6 million, right? Anything above that, there's a bunch of nuance there where like you don't want to raise at too high of a valuation automatically, but for most first-time founders, that's not going to be a problem. It's just going to be like fundraising itself is going to be difficult.
Yeah.
So I would just think about it as how much are you willing to dilute to get this capital? And I think there's a lot of times where I'll talk to founders and they'll have investors that are interested, but they just feel like they're selling too much of their company. 20 to 30% is kind of standard for a pre-seed, seed, and Series A round in terms of dilution. And like, if you need that capital to go build the company, again, it's your job is to keep the company alive. So go get that capital, even if it's not exactly the valuation you want it, right? Because your goal is basically to get the ability to keep building the company. Yeah. And theoretically, your valuation is going to be 100x that in a few years, right?
So it doesn't matter almost.
Well, it's just, it's more like it's not going to make or break the company, right? So I think it's an equation. It's how much dilution are you willing to take? How much money do you need to get to the next inflection point? And just work backwards.
Do you say 20% is kind of ballpark acceptable in each round?
Yeah. So like foundation ballpark capital, we target about 20% on our initial investment. So we're very high conviction, high touch, high ownership investors. But most, if you're like an institutional seed fund where you do seed rounds as your bread and butter, you're going to need at least 12%, more than likely like 15% is going to be kind of that target area. And then on top of that, you don't want to be the only investor in the company. You want them to have other strategic investors or other value add people or smaller funds also participating. So if, like, let's say foundation comes in, we need 20%. So if you're not willing to sell, you know, 25% of the company, it might not be just the right fit in terms of like the fund dynamics, right? If you're only willing to sell 10% of the company, I see this a lot with companies that are trying to fundraise for the first time. They'll try to raise $500,000 and value the company at $6 million. That's 12.5%. So that's just a no-go from the beginning from someone like a foundation, because that doesn't fit our financial model, right? And a lot of other institutional funds are the same way. So that means that you've got to go raise that 500K from individuals and angels, which is totally fine. It just means it's a very different approach, different funnel, different way to kind of create leverage and close the round.
That's very interesting perspective. And I'm curious, should people thinking about which firm to approach, think about check size, percentage, or think about the stage, or all in about?
Yeah, so let's move into the second phase of the overall fundraising process, because this goes into a lot of that. The second phase is called qualification. Qualification is you've got everything ready to go, you know how much you're raising, you've got a pitch deck, whatever. Now you've got a list of, let's call it, to use a round number, 100 investors. If you're fundraising for the first time, it's probably going to be like 200 or 250, right? The job in qualification is to meet as many of those 100 investors as possible and actually approach them and say, hey, I'm not fundraising right now. This is who I am. This is my company. This is my vision for what we're going to build over the next, you know, 6 months to a year. This is our plan. Does this idea resonate with you? Does my approach resonate with you? What are the metrics you would want to see that would get you excited about investing in my company? What does your process look like? What does your timeline look like? What do you have ownership targets? Do you need a board seat? Like, it's your, like, your goal with qualification is to extract information from as many investors as possible, because what that's going to allow you to do is benchmark yourself and see if you're going to be able to successfully fundraise, and also filter out all the investors that are just not the right fit. Right. So I gave the example where if you're only going to sell 15% of the company, it's probably not a good fit for someone like a foundation.
20%.
That, so of those 100 people you talk to, right, let's say you talk to all 100, 50 will not be a fit because they've got another investment in the space. They're overexposed. The ownership targets don't match up. Their check size is too big or too small. Just infinite number of reasons that have nothing to do with the company, your approach, you as a founder, whatever. So it's good to kind of get that out of the way initially and know that before you're actually in a process where you're actively fundraising looking for a term sheet, right? The second thing is that last 50, 30 of them will just not like your approach or not like the market that you're going after. It'll be not a fit for other reasons. Then you're left with the last 20. And of those 20, let's call 5 to 10 are potential lead investors, meaning they'll write a term sheet, they'll price the round, they'll kind of take the biggest chunk of it. And then the other 10 to 15 are follow-on investors, meaning if you get a term sheet, they will invest some smaller amount on the same terms as that lead investor. So your job is really to take that world of 100 and cut it down to 20 in the qualification stage. And the reason this is so important is that as an investor, you want to retain optionality, right? You don't want to give a yes or a no, because the more time you give a company, the more opportunities there are for them to make an awesome hire or get a big customer. It de-risks the business. So when you approach an investor and you start off by just saying, hey, I'm fundraising, this is what my company's doing, like, can we talk? Well, now they're in decision-making mode. So they're going to be a little bit less honest and upfront about what they think, because they, again, want to reserve that optionality. And a lot of times what'll end up happening, I'm sure you've heard this from founders you work with, is they'll say, hey, this is exciting, come back when you've done X, right? And so then the founder's like, okay, awesome, they're interested, let me go do X. And they'll put their head down, they'll work, they'll achieve X, and they'll come back and they'll say, hey, investor, I achieved X, like, do you want to invest? They're like, oh, this is really great progress. I'm really interested to see if you can do Y, like, come back when you've done Y. And they'll kind of keep moving the goalposts, because again, there's no incentive for them to make that first move, right? It's actually in their incentives to wait and see what's going to evolve with the company.
So how do founder turn that table? Because that's a difficult choice, right?
So that's where the third phase comes in, right? Which is execution. And we could talk about that, but I want to spend a little more time on qualification.
Yes, please.
Because I think the other piece of qualification is you're extracting this information, so you're going to waste less time when you move into the last phase, but you're also going to understand, am I in a good position to fundraise, right? So
define that,
Well, going back to what I talked about with the template, right? Well, now that you've talked to 50 investors and you know what metrics they're looking for, just look in your spreadsheet. Yeah. Do you have those metrics?
Yeah.
If you do, great. You can probably go fundraise. If you don't, how much more runway do you need to get there? And then you go raise angel capital, a bridge round, whatever you want to call it. Give yourself that runway to hit those metrics. Because the worst is to go out and actively fundraise when you don't have the traction that people are looking for, because then there's really no incentive for anyone to offer you a term sheet. And that's where you kind of waste a lot of your time and spin your wheels. So tying this all together to the third phase, execution is once you've talked to these 100 investors and you've identified, all right, these 80 are just not fits. These 20, I've already met. I already know what they're looking for and I have it, or at least I'm close to having it. Ideally, I've been keeping them updated on my progress since we met through investor updates or sending them personal emails. So they've watched me execute, right? They've de-risked that execution piece. Your job with execution is really to run a sales process. So reach out to all VCs. Don't like this, by the way, because this gives founders a lot more leverage and makes it a lot harder for them to do their jobs. But really, you reach out to all 20 of those pre-qualified investors in parallel. And you say, hey, so-and-so, it was great meeting you 3 months ago, 3 weeks ago, you know, a year ago. We're formally, like, things have been going well. We've made XYZ progress. We're formally launching our fundraising round next Monday. We're anticipating term sheets by this date and targeting a final close by this date. Let's have a diligence conversation. What materials would you like to see? What that allows you to do is create momentum and an incentive for a lead investor to offer you a term sheet. Because now you can go into those conversations and say, hey, I've been executing. It's really good. As you know, we formally launched the round at the beginning of the week. We've got about 10 conversations lined up with folks that we think would be good potential leads. Another 10 to 15 lined up with folks that have indicated an interest in coming in with a lead term sheet. You know, we think this type of terms are fair. Like, what do you think? You know? And the position that puts the investor in is, if I'm Foundation Capital and I need 20% of the company and you're only selling 25%, if another investor comes in and offers you a term sheet,
you're too late.
I can't do it anymore, right? Even if I really love the deal, love the founder, love the team, et cetera, the only real reason that I have an incentive to make the first move is because if I don't, someone else will.
Mm.
And it's really hard to create that momentum unless you've already built this rapport with these investors through qualifying them.
Yeah.
And then now you've got this time box process where you've set expectations.
Mm-hmm.
They know you're talking to other people. It's not in like a rude way of like, oh, I have options.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, hey, I launched my round. I've been talking to investors and I think we're going to get, you know, someone's going to get me a term sheet, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you offer me one first, I'm much more inclined to just take yours and close the round,
mm-hmm.
right? So you're creating that incentive and momentum. And the last thing that doing it in this process allows you to do is not really play both sides off of each other, but like slowly build momentum. Where if you're talking to someone that you know is a follow-on investor, you kind of say something similar where it's like, hey, as you know, I launched the round Monday. We've got great conversations going with about 10 potential leads. We think a round is going to come together that looks something like this in terms of like the terms. If the term sheet were to be at those terms, do you want an allocation? How much allocation do you want? And they'll say, oh yeah, I would like to invest. I will take 200K of that allocation. That's great. And now when you go back to the lead investors, you can say, hey, this is a great follow-up conversation. We're still progressing with a few other funds and we've got soft commitments from these follow-on funds that they'll put, you know, if you put in 1.5 million and give me a term sheet, they'll put in the other 1 million, right? To kind of round out that $2.5 million fundraising round, right? So it helps you kind of build progress on both sides. But it's only possible because you've done this qualification section.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, the biggest mistake that I notice founders making is they think when it's time to fundraise, you just prepare and then go pitch a bunch of VCs.
Mm-hmm.
And really that middle part is about building relationships with them and de-risking execution.
Mm-hmm.
Like one, making sure that there's alignment in terms of their investment strategy, your company, your approach, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But two, like showing them, hey, since we've met, I've built the company, we've made a lot of progress.
Yeah.
Imagine what more we could do if we had capital, right? And
yeah.
combine that with an incentive to make the first move. And that's how you can really be successful kind of raising a good fundraising round.
This is like, wow. This is like, I feel like a secret behind a secret in a way where a lot of founders did not know that. And I can totally see how that could be so not only intentional, but impactful.
It's really interesting because it's just understanding the venture capital business model
mm-hmm.
and the incentives that that creates.
Yeah.
And I think so often, yeah, people don't fully understand the way that the investor's business works. And if you don't understand that, then you don't understand their incentives and it's mm-hmm. a lot harder to position yourself correctly.
I think you make a great point that investors want to have options. So therefore, even they might like you, but there's no really motivation for them to move unless they are really exciting deal. And mm-hmm. therefore create that time box like you speak about so you can be in charge of that process and mm-hmm. you can use the momentum to drive all the leaders coming with you in the pace you like to go with and close around quickly, go build a company.
Exactly. Exactly.
Talk about the time. And I know it completely varies from case to case. Roughly speaking, what does the process time look like? Is it 3 months, 3 years? I know it's so...
Yeah, yeah. So qualification, I generally recommend founders just do this passively as they're building their company,
mm-hmm.
right? And what that means is, let's say you're able to close like a pre-seed round or some angel funding, or even you're just building an MVP mm-hmm. kind of in your spare time, right? Start talking to investors then. And again, approach it as kind of a qualification discussion. This is who I am. This is my idea. This is where I see it going. Like, do you like it?
Mm-hmm.
What would get you excited about investing in it? Blah, blah, blah. Because you don't need to do them all back to back, right?
Yeah,
you can do that over like a 6 month time span,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
The goal is really in that case to get to where you've got, I would recommend for a first time fundraiser, 50 qualified investors,
mm-hmm.
right? More than you would think, right? And to get 50 qualified, you got to talk to 250, right? So spread that out over time, right?
Wow.
It's a lot harder than mm-hmm. it seems in TechCrunch.
Okay, so more specifically,
well, so then
how to build a list? Where did 250 come about first place?
Yeah, so I guess first, just to wrap that in a bow.
Yeah, please.
The execution piece, I would say that should take about 2 months. Give yourself like 3 to 4 months though.
For 250 people?
Well, no. So remember, that's qualification.
Yes, that's a
separate time. Execution is just when you say you've already pre-qualified them.
Yep.
So, hey, 50 pre-qualified. We're launching the round now. Uh-huh. 6 weeks from now, we expect to have a term sheet.
Got it.
And 4 weeks after that, we expect to just have the round closed.
Got it.
To set expectations.
That's roughly about 10 weeks. You speak in there, but set everything up.
But again, you can only do it in that 10 weeks because you've done this six months of work ahead of time.
Yeah.
So I would say over the course of 6 months, try to have at least 150 or 200 investor conversations.
Yeah.
So now to answer your question about where to build lists, there's tons of awesome stuff online. OpenVC is a good resource. Signal by NFX, the fund, is a really good resource. Groups like Capital Factory have whole 1,000-person lists of investor databases. You can search on Twitter. There's really a ton of opportunities out there to identify potential investors. And I would just there's a great Airtable template to do this. So just start adding people to your Airtable template.
I think it's not about where to find the people because, like you said, the list where the people is abundance everywhere, anywhere. It's more about how to approach them. Is it LinkedIn DM? Is it email? Because you said, we are not raising. I'm just, hello, my name is Wen. This is what I do. I'd love to kind of hear you. Do you like it? Almost like a very casual and not very...
Yeah, there's this fun saying that if you want money, ask for advice. If you want advice, ask for money. And that's
I love it.
Very, very true, right?
Yeah.
So my recommendation would be one, cold email works. Just do it in a thoughtful way.
Yeah.
Don't include too much information. Keep it really short. Don't do too many follow-ups. Maybe do one or two follow-ups max. And try to personalize it or customize it.
Yeah.
And the second piece of advice would be genuinely have a way that they could help you and approach the conversation from that lens. Hey, I'm thinking through my pricing strategy. Should I make it transactional or should I keep a seat-based SaaS model? Right. I know that you've got this investment that has switched over to a usage-based pricing model. I'd love to talk to you, share some about my situation and get your thoughts on it, right? Or, hey, I saw you post this thought piece on how to build marketplace as well. I'm struggling with this piece of it. I'd love to pick your brain and get some advice around this, right? Mm-hmm. That does two things. One, it gives a very clear reason why you're reaching out beyond eventually wanting to raise money from them.
Yeah.
But two, it helps you kind of work with them and understand, is this someone that you want to work with that can actually be helpful to you beyond just providing you with capital? Mm-hmm. And I think it's really thoughtful. And again, let's say you go into that conversation and through the qualification process, you realize it's just not a fit. Well, at least now they've answered a question for you. And so you've gotten some value out of it no matter what, no matter what, it's not a waste of your time. So I think email works well, LinkedIn DMs work well. Some firms have a form on their website. I think just try all the avenues. Mm-hmm. Email, I think, is a pretty solid mechanism.
Yeah.
And then warm intros and platforms like Signal by NFX can help you identify warm intros. LinkedIn is helpful to find warm intros. Just try every single possibility that you can. And again, your goal is not to raise the money then. Your goal is just to get a conversation and get their advice on some piece of your business and then explore if there's an opportunity later on the road for them to invest.
I love that so much because I think a lot of founders just don't know what to say to investors. They were like, well, it's pretty obvious. I need the money. And we all know that. And I love that. I love that you break it. You make it so simple and clear. And no wonder you are the people leader and people matter in that sense where at the end of the day, it's just about building relationships. Think about a friend you made. Think about in a classmate you have, a colleague you have, right? It's about having that dialogue. And it's not just about, I think at the end of the people knows you probably wanted to have investment down the road, but having that early conversation, whether it is asking a specific advice or comment about a thought piece they share, just kind of being engaged, I think is really thoughtful.
One helpful rubric that I've heard is, let's say you do 5 of these a week, right? You're a founder. You spend an hour a week writing 5 personalized emails. So that's 12 minutes an email.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough time to research their LinkedIn, research their Twitter, read an article they wrote, whatever. If you do 5 a week for 10 weeks, that's 50 people.
Wow.
Right?
That's a good math.
They're not all going to respond, right? But you don't need to do the hyper-personalized outreach for everyone, right?
Yeah.
It's really just these top investors that you really want to get in front of. There's usually not going to be more than 50 of them. And then for the other 150, 200, that's where you do more of like a scaled outbound approach. But yes, it's just like in any best practice for like go to market for a company, your goal is to really try to add value and have a conversation. And if you're solving a problem that they need, then it'll naturally turn into kind of a customer conversation. Or if you're really building a company that's exciting, it'll naturally turn into a fundraising conversation.
I do want to ask about vehicles. We talked about earlier about the evaluation and such and the equity. Talk about vehicle for us.
Yeah, I think like in general, convertible note, safe note, they're kind of the same thing. A convertible note has interest attached to it. You've got to renew it after a certain point. There's a little more complexity. I would recommend if you're raising $2 million or less, just raise it on safe notes. It's very simple. It's very standard. You understand exactly what your dilution is going to be. Each individual investment is on their own individual safe note. So it's easy to just close checks as people are interested. I think a post-money safe, meaning that the valuation is a post-money valuation, not a pre-money valuation. That's the way to go. If you're raising anything beyond that, you're going to have to do a priced round. And at that point, you got to get lawyers involved. I don't think it should be super complicated. Like just do a safe note. If there's an angel investor that's like, I'll only do a convertible note. It's case by case, kind of use your best judgment. The only difference between a convertible note and a safe note is that a convertible note expires after some time period, which means that you need to either extend the duration or pay the money back with interest at that point or give them the equity with interest at that point. And then the interest is the other additional component. So I'd say try to do safe notes if you can for early stage fundraising.
2 million or lower, safe notes. Any above that, convertible notes or potentially have a lawyer.
Anything above that, I would go a priced round.
Priced round.
Yeah.
So skip this convertible note altogether.
Yeah. I think so convertible notes were kind of superseded by safe notes because safe notes are just much easier and simpler for everyone involved.
Okay. Wonderful. This is so exciting. I love that process breakdown. So we just quickly summarize and then we talk a little bit jumping here and there. So step one is doing all the prep work, getting your pitch deck ready, getting your kind of understanding about evaluation, understand what benchmark, the spreadsheet that you speak about, building the spreadsheet internally, knowing where you are, where you want to head into next, knowing all the KPIs. That's a step one, getting the qualification. And step two, like Jake mentioned, now is doing the soft conversation. What do you call it?
Yeah, the qualification.
Qualification. Thank you.
Preparation, qualification, execution.
Qualification. And this moment, you're going to reaching out, maybe not reaching out. First of all, start with a list. 200, 250 lists, you know, in the firm, individuals who are in alignment with your thesis, your sector and such. And from there, you know, you mentioned about we can reaching out to them through LinkedIn, to email, or warm intro, all the different mechanisms to just having a conversation. Again, ask for advice, never for money. And from there, we're going to shorten it for like the 50, like the list. And then from that moment, we're going to tell people, hey guys, we are starting our round for future Monday until the future 4 weeks, 6 weeks and such, given the time frame. And now we can really keep that conversation going and expect to close the round probably 10 weeks or
the course of the next 2 to 3 months.
Got it.
Yeah.
Great. So basically a 6 months qualification, 1 or 2 months-ish, if you really focus, closing around.
Yeah. And I mean, you can qualify faster, right? Like if you can get those 250 conversations done in 2-3 months, then
that's
then
possible.
Great. Yeah. I mean, it's just about how much time you as the CEO can dedicate to fundraising, right? If all you're doing, you're spending 40, 50 hours a week trying to talk to investors, you'll probably do it a lot quicker.
Like 2 months?
It's entirely variable. The point is really just approaching the investors before you're actively asking them for money so that you can show yourself executing.
Yeah.
So you can make sure you're not wasting time, so you can build rapport with the investors, et cetera.
Okay, this is a dumb question, but what if founder right now listening and say, wow, when, but I need money now. Can I still do a pre-qualification process?
That's what bridge rounds are for, and angel rounds, right?
Okay.
No one wants to invest in a company that is about to go out of business or run out of money, right?
Yeah.
Like that's venture capital is already very risky. Startups mostly fail. So why would I invest in a company that's literally about to fail, right? So my recommendation would be, again, go back to the spreadsheet, figure out, all right, at what point do my metrics become exciting? How much additional runway do I need to get to that point? And then you go raise from angel investors, right? This process really is more important if you're raising from an institutional fund, right? Because that's when you get the dynamics where only one person can be the lead investor. Like that's kind of where all that comes from. So if you need money now, start with your existing investors. Be like, hey, I need money now. Otherwise the company's going to go out of business. This is what I'm going to use the money for. This is like why I am in this position in the first place. The more upfront and open you can be with the existing investors, like throughout this process, the more likely they are to give you some of that additional funding, but then get whatever else you need from angels. Because again, if you're raising on a safe note or a convertible note, you can close money as it comes in and just get enough to where, like, again, your goal is to give yourself 3 months post hitting the metrics when you want to fundraise, right?
3 months post.
Yes. Because again, like if you're only just hitting the metrics as your company's about to run out of money, that doesn't look like a very good investment. You need to give yourself wiggle room because also things don't go as planned. And now when you're talking to investors, you're able to run that, you know, 8 to 10 week execution process and still have leftover time in case things don't go as planned.
Wow, so much math.
Yeah.
So essentially.
It's easy math, but yes, there's a lot of math. And that's why it's more an art than a science. Like, you can, there's really interesting ways. Like once you have this spreadsheet, and I can show you, like we've got like templates for this.
Would you mind
sending
that? I would love to put that in the attachment so founder can, if that's okay.
Yeah, no, no, it's a very, basically like a very simplified version of a financial model.
Okay.
And what's interesting is that you can play around with the way that you fundraise, right? Where, okay, so let's say now I could go out and raise a $2 million seed round, right? But with my metrics now, my valuation is not going to be any higher than 10 million, right? Or I could raise 500,000 now, and then that gives me an extra 6 months of runway. So if I then go to raise the seed round 3 months later than I had originally planned, well, now that $2 million that I raise is going to be at a $15 million valuation. So you can actually end up diluting yourself less.
Understood.
Or you could raise more now and then you're basically like, there's lots of ways you can play with the amounts.
The time,
that
timing.
Will exactly coincide with different inflection points of the business. And there's like 4 or 5 different viable strategies. You just kind of pick the one that seems like you're most likely going to be able to execute on it.
This is just so incredibly exciting, Jake. I love that you have such a insight because you really, you know, supporting both ends, supporting on the founder and you see probably advising so many of her or him in their process, but also speak to so many incredible investors, whether it's in Capital Factory or today, the founding part of, you see the both sides. So the way how you really dismissify this process is very clear and very refreshing.
Yeah. Well, it's all Chris Traylor and John Durbin. I basically got like a college major in that because that program was 5 hours once a month on like a Monday from noon to five and then a few follow-up sessions. And I just sat in on every month for 2.5 years until we made it like a fully virtual program. So I've gotten my like 200 hours of education in it or whatever. And,
And tell us, what are you up to today? And what are you most excited about for the next?
I work at Foundation Capital today and I lead portfolio operations. Really, it's two main functions. One is kind of general VC platform responsibilities. So onboarding companies to the portfolio, you know, connecting them with other founders, perks, vendor recommendations, service providers, things like that. And then the second half is managing our executive ecosystem. So this is kind of like an advisor, mentor, customer network that Foundation manages. So we've got about 100 plus VP C-level executives at big Fortune 500s and kind of unicorn startups. And so what takes up most of my time nowadays is growing that network, bringing more awesome executives into the network, and then basically connecting them with our founders to help them solve problems. So it's really interesting. I get to hear problems that people at, you know, multi-billion dollar companies are actually experiencing and how that maps to startups and then make relevant introductions from the startup to the executive, vice versa. So that's kind of what I'm doing work-wise, and I'm just learning a ton because Foundation, it's the firm is older than I am, which is kind of incredible. They did Netflix's seed round. That was kind of their first big investment that really took off, but they invested in Groupon and Chegg more recently, companies like Cohesity, Eightfold, Solana, Jasper AI here in town. They invested back in 2019.
Oh, yeah.
So they're really incredible investors. And
yeah.
I'm kind of the first non-investor hire. We have a talent partner as well that kind of precedes me by about a year, but I'm really trying to define, like, what does it mean to be a portfolio company of Foundation? Like, yes, you get access to the capital and you have one of our partners on your board, but like, what are other ways that we can kind of help accelerate your process of building a big company?
Do you want to give the pitch for Foundation? So in case our founders are at the end,
Right fit. So Foundation Capital, we invest $1 to $10 million initial checks. Like I mentioned, we are high conviction, high touch, high ownership investors. So we do typically take board seats, work really closely with the founders. We focus on three main areas. The first is fintech. Mm-hmm. Within fintech, very broad, but specifically a thesis around embedded fintech. Mm-hmm. So embedded insurance, embedded payments, like basically allowing other companies to offer those types of products within their own existing software.
Got it.
Another thesis around hybrid finance, which is basically using crypto and blockchain as the backend infrastructure for any existing kind of financial service or product.
It's amazing.
The second focus area is enterprise software. Within enterprise software, we look at cybersecurity, developer tooling, and DevOps platforms. So making developers more effective and efficient. Machine learning and data infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So how do you let other companies give them the infrastructure to build up their own models? And then applied AI apps. So these are things like Jasper, like applying AI, ML, automation to any specific business function like sales, marketing, now more and more data analysis, engineering, et cetera. And then the third focus area is crypto. And within crypto, we look for where blockchain, again, intersects with an existing focus area, either on the fintech side or on the enterprise side.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's a great fund. And any interest investors like or interested startups, happy to chat and see who I can connect you with.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And Jay, tell us, what are you excited about today for yourself?
I'm really excited about AI and large language models.
And you run a huge community. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I spent like July through March of this past year, 2022, traveling. Really, I grew up and lived in Texas my whole life. And I decided it was, you know, if I was going to settle down, I should at least see what else is out there. So I spent some time in Seattle, some time in Denver, and some time in San Francisco.
Nice.
Really loved all of it. I was in San Francisco January to March. And while I was there, there was basically all these AI events all the time. And some of them were informative, but a lot of them were just kind of, hey, there's a bunch of people excited about AI. Some of them are engineers. Some of them are entrepreneurs. Some of them work at a big company. They just want to meet other people excited about it. So I was able to make a lot of friends and great connections through going to that. And when I came back to Austin, I just did a quick kind of Google search and like asked some friends like, hey, where do you go to meet other people excited about or building with AI? And the stuff I found was all really focused on more technical conversations, educating people on what a vector database is or things like that. And there was a big gap for just kind of an open AI meetup, happy hour, basically. So I was like, all right, well, if no one else is doing this, I'll do it. And so I found some good friends of mine here in Austin. One runs their own kind of dev shop doing a lot of AI projects.
Yeah.
The other runs an ML ops company and also an AI venture studio here in town called 12fold.
Wow.
The other is just a founder building an AI company. And so we all have kind of tangential networks to each other. So we decided to partner together. And so now we host a monthly meetup called AITX. It happens at Capital Factory. It's actually tonight. So I'm hosting it tonight.
What time?
5 to 7 p.m.
Okay. Well, we're going to leave next week. So
yeah.
You're going to miss that.
And it really, the idea is it's a pretty open happy hour networking.
Okay.
We provide pizza. It's not happy hour. We don't provide drinks, but we provide pizza.
Yes, what pizza?
Free pizza. We do a little bit of like pitching. Like basically I'll have 3 to 5 founders come up, but the way they'll pitch is they'll actually just have 90 seconds.
Mm.
So it's more about who are you? What are you working on? How can people in the audience help you?
Mm.
And then we set everybody that shares what they're working on up with like a demo table.
Wow.
So they can actually show people, people can interact with it. And yeah, it seems like we've tapped into a source of demand. We've got over 450 people I checked this morning that are like RSVP'd to come. Usually we have between 70 and 100 people show up. They had to upgrade us from a smaller classroom to a bigger classroom,
yeah,
at Capital Factory to facilitate it. And
yeah,
it's just been awesome to meet local people in Austin, yeah, that are excited about AI.
I love that, Jay.
So yeah, been excited about that, working on that, working on some side projects, kind of using AI to mm-hmm. solve some sort of problem that I experience. So one is kind of like a CRM solution that basically makes it to where you don't have to tag people anymore. We'll use generative AI to like generate a bio. So Wynn is the founder and CEO of the If Not Now, Wynn,
yeah,
Institute, right? Yeah.
Thank you for the memory.
Previously, she grew up in China. She immigrated here, blah, blah, blah. And then we basically vectorize that. So turn it into something that computers can understand,
mm-hmm,
and make it semantically searchable. So now rather than like, let's say I need a marketing executive for one of our portfolio companies, instead of finding like a tag and filtering down by marketing, I just type marketing executive with experience at growth stage SaaS and hit search. Mm-hmm. And based on the bio and the information we generate about you, it'll find the most relevant people. So,
that's so cool.
It's so cool. It's a lot of fun. It's really hard to do with kind of a full-time job. And
yeah,
that's kind of what I mean by like, I really have so much respect for founders that are doing this full-time because it's really, really hard. Mm. And then the other thing I'm working on is called, I'm calling it shower thoughts. And basically like, it's this way to, I always have these thoughts and ideas when I'm like getting ready for bed or I'm in a shower or whatever of
everybody
like
is
tasks and action items and whatever. And so the system I'm building is it'll text you every day at whatever time you want. And it'll basically like ask you questions. It'll be, who did you meet with today? What did you do today? What projects did you work on? And you just talk to it, mm-hmm, kind of record a voice memo, brain dumping.
I need that.
I'll send it to you after this. It's ready to go.
Yeah.
Showerthoughts.ai if anyone wants to use it.
Yes, because I'm always have this moment, but I don't have time to write it down.
Exactly. So, and most people are way better at communicating with audio than they are at typing things out.
Oh, I'm so me.
Yeah. Yes. So the system basically will just take that brain dump with all these different tangents that you go on, whatever.
Yeah.
It'll summarize it. It'll extract like highlights of what you actually did in that day and action items and then send that directly to your inbox.
And you build that?
Yeah.
And you just have people use it for free?
Yeah, it's free right now. Anyone can use it at showerthoughts.ai.
That's so cool. Okay, make sure to send it to me. We're going to attach to a show notes.
Course,
everyone
yeah.
have access to it.
I'll send you the other thing too. It's called Sarin. That's the semantic CRM thing.
Okay.
They're both live. They're both totally free. Anyone can use them. It's just really good experience to like learn how to build these things. Like I said, I'm a government major. And so ChatGPT has been this huge unlock where I know enough about Python that I kind of understand how it works.
Mm.
And it's enabled me to help. It's helped me debug basically to where now I can code things. I can program them. I can put them on a web page. And it's really because of ChatGPT.
Jake, you are so cool. I felt if I can summarize you in one sentence, you know, quote from Gandhi is, I think you are just always be the change we all want to see in the world.
Mm, thank you.
Whether you see a big problem at, whether at a capital factor at the time or whatever process you're part of, you see there's a big opportunity, you jump in. And with today, you just casually mention, oh, I'm also build this thing and this thing and this thing and also run this, you know, community. I'm also support this thing. I was like, wow, how many hours of a day you have? But I also know that you have a big heart to just want to support people, just want to connecting.
Well, and I don't do most of these things alone, right?
Like yeah.
I've got a bunch of co-organizers for AITX.
But still.
Yeah. I think one thing that I've noticed is that a lot of people get caught up in not doing, like finding excuses to not do something. And if you just are willing to put yourself out there and do it, you're way ahead of most other people. So you've kind of just got to bite the bullet. And the first few meetups were like really uncomfortable, like really nerve wracking, etc.
Yeah.
But now that I've bitten the bullet and you know, we've done it a few times, like I feel confident this next one's going to be great. And I'm just less nervous about it.
Yeah.
And Yeah.
My last question is, what does a legacy mean for you one day, Jake?
It's hard to think about legacy. I'm 26.
Or something that you felt would be cool one day to live, or the world can think about you and think about that particular aspect.
Yeah. Maybe I'll reframe the question a little bit, because I liked what you asked Ron in the last podcast I listened to, of like, what does success mean to you?
Yeah,
and for me, it's like, it's on different dimensions, right? Professionally, for me, success means that I can work on things because I'm interested in them without needing any sort of monetary compensation to come along with that, right? So that means basically getting to a point where you can work on things and not worry about it, like putting food on the table or rent, right? And I'm not there at all, anywhere near there, right? But kind of professionally, that's where I want to be someday. And then personally, it's just, you know, being present and helpful and just like loving on my friends and my family. And like, it's hard to kind of balance and juggle all those things. Like, legacy wise, who knows? Like, we'll see where it goes. I really just want to have a positive impact on people that I work with or that I interact with.
You already have.
Oh, thank you. You've had a positive impact on me, Wen. This has been wonderful. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh my God. Thank you. Honors all me and all of us, because, you know, truly, Jay, you have so much to offer. And I want you just know that you have made so much impact on all the founders you speak to, whether it's Capital Factory or Foundation today, or through the meetup, the community you are building, every single conversation, every single impact, it is opportunity that you had to make impact. And specifically today, you come on here and just being so open book and speak about those experiences, insight that a lot of founders are really struggling, and there's not much information out there about that. It's not really a playbook out there. And the fact that you kind of really spill the beans, if I may, and now founders really have a clear steps, even templates to go out there to approach this conversation, I'm pretty sure that you are changing one life or two minimum on that regard.
Oh, thank you so much.
So with that, Jay, truly, thank you so much for being here today. I am so honored. I so appreciate you being here.
It was my pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you and thank you. And also thank you for everybody who tuned in today. We hope you enjoyed as much as I do. And I cannot wait to see you all next week. Bye, guys.